Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a looming European financial crisis as the summit of 27 heads of EU states in Brussels failed to come to an agreement, putting off a possible resolution until next Wednesday. With Greece already in collapse and Spain, Portugal and Italy teetering, it is looking more and more likely that the contagion will spread to the United States and deepen and prolong the recession we are stuck in, making the Republicans, whose policies are accelerating our economic decline, more likely to be elected. Dimitri Papadimitriou, who just returned from Europe, joins us. He is the president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified on a number of occasions before Senate and House committees of the U.S. Congress and is a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. Then finally, we'll speak with a professor of political economy at Northwestern University, Jeffrey Winters, the author of a new book, Oligarchy. He has studied the oligarchs of ancient Greece and Rome, as well as contemporary Indonesia and the Philippines, and by comparison finds America's oligarchs unusually greedy. We will examine the American right's fetishizing of the wealthy and powerful as its contempt for the weak and needy becomes more apparent. For the last couple of years on Background Briefing, we have questioned how much our democracy has succumbed to the power of concentrated wealth, so much so that listeners have complained that I was using the word oligarchy and plutonomy too much. But now, with a 99% movement spreading across the country and around the world, it is clear to a growing number of people that America's oligarchs and their political hirelings control our economy and own our politics, effectively disenfranchising the majority of American voters. And joining us now is Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified on a number of occasions in hearings of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives committees of the U.S. Congress and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and was a member of the Competitive Policy Council's sub-council on capital allocation. He's also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dimitri Papadimitriou.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you've just returned from Europe, and on Sunday the European ministers met, and apparently they're going to meet again. This is the 27 heads of state of the EU states. They're apparently going to meet again on Wednesday, and the feeling is that this Eurozone crisis, the economics have always raged ahead of the politicians. In other words, the markets are too fast and the politicians are too slow. Is there anything to indicate that this is going to change?
I'm afraid not. The uninspired leadership from the European leaders will continue. You know, everybody had his or her eyes to the today's summit, only to be disappointed, to postpone the decision for next Wednesday, only again to be postponed until something could be announced on the November 3rd when the G20 meetings are held. And this is again the inability from Chancellor Merkel as well as President Sarkozy, who don't seem to agree on what the solution for the Eurozone crisis is. A number of proposals have been put forth from either side, which are not acceptable because that will impose some difficulties on the banks, both in France, as well as on the private sector investors who will take a much bigger haircut than was originally proposed in their July sort of summit, asking for the private sector investor to take a 21% haircut for the Greek bonds, now speaking about a 50 to 60% haircut, which is substantial given what the holdings of the French banks are and the rest of the Eurozone member state banks. But there isn't any solution, you know, because what we're dealing is with the inability to understand what the real problem is, which is that you cannot solve the problem with this level of financing. It's not possible.
Well, there's a tremendous gulf, surely, Dimitri, Papa Dimitri, between the 100 billion that they're talking about, euros, and what apparently is required, which is estimates are between 1.3 trillion and 2.6 trillion.
Yes, you know, the 1.7 trillion that has been actually mentioned is highly inadequate if you were to take only the periphery countries. And assume that there may be a sovereign default because of the contagion that will come about from the inability to actually ring-fence Greece, if that were ever possible, you have others that will then follow. You know the pressures that we have seen on two of the largest economies in the Eurozone, which is Italy and Spain. Now, these are substantial exposures of sovereign debt. And you cannot solve it with 1 trillion euros. You are talking about $3 and even more trillion. And, you know, a number of proposals have been put forth to leverage the European Financial Stability Facility. You know, leverage is great on the way up, but on the way down is extremely painful. And we have seen this in the United States of America.
Again, I'm speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He's just returned from Europe, where on Sunday, 27 heads of the EU states met, apparently didn't come to an agreement, have said that there's another meeting on Wednesday. Meanwhile, there's a great deal of concern that the political authorities are simply not keeping pace with the economic crisis. And what do you make of the collapse of the Dexia Bank, French-Belgian bank?
It's not surprising to me, actually, that the bank has collapsed. This is the second time that it's been bailed out. Of course, now it's been broken up, and therefore there is possibility of at least one part of it surviving, the consumer part of it, that's left with Belgium. The exposure of these banks and insurance companies are dramatic. When you begin to have an inability from the core to solve the problem, we will see other financial institutions actually experiencing this type of problems. We know that the French banks are worried. The announcement that they should have a 9% Tier 1 capital with any possibility of a 50% or 60% haircut from the Greek bonds, they would need to raise a lot of money. You know, the estimates, as you correctly pointed out earlier, may be much larger than what they assume of the 100 billion euros, could be as high as 300 billion euros. So the question then is, would they be able to raise these funds privately with increases in their capital for the private sector, or would they seek support from the respective governments? Well, some banks don't really want to receive any support from their governments, because that means that there are certain restrictions in terms of pay and other kinds of expansion, other kinds of things that private institutions like banks don't want to deal with. On the other hand, they will have to, because the haircut is going to be more than 50 or 60%. And in my estimation, we're looking for a total default from the Greek state. It's not possible to service a loan, given that the economy has been deteriorating sharply. The estimates that somehow or other, miraculously, the economy will get out of recession 2 years from now and return to some growth pattern, it's actually pure fantasy. So we are looking for a serious problem. And, of course, that's not going to stay there because, as we know, the Portuguese deficit is actually very high. It's close to 10% last year, and the improvements are not going to be great there either. And Spain isn't actually showing any growth, let alone that there are revisions in the growth rates for France and also for Germany. So the more they wait to solve this problem, the worse it will get. And we're talking a severe crisis that may actually lead to a global crisis, not only limited to the Eurozone. And if I may continue, there are about $3 billion that the American financial institutions are basically exposed to, half of it of which is from the mutual funds that have invested in European banks, and the other half is the other financial institutions. No wonder you see that both President Obama as well as Tim Geithner are urging for a solution to the European crisis. There is something to be said about the contagion on the other side of the pond.
Well, particularly when American banks are heavily exposed in Spain, Ireland, and Italy. And Italy, apparently, at this meeting on Sunday of the European ministers, apparently their concern was expressed that the budget cuts passed by the Italian parliament didn't go far enough.
Yes.
And that Italy needs to borrow $250 billion next year just to refinance its existing debts. You've just laid out, Papadimitriou, a fairly broad menu of weak points. You say that Greece has already fallen off the cliff and the other ones are poised on the cliff. Are they all going to – is the dam going to all break at once or in stages?
I wish I could say that I see some omens of optimism, but I don't. They don't need to wait for Wednesday to solve the problem. They know what the problem is, and they know that the solution can actually not come about with just kicking the can down the road. You know, in a sense of a comparison, the United States of America, the federal government controls 20% of GDP. The European Parliament controls 1% of GDP. How is it possible then to stabilize that economy? Either you have United States of Europe or you have an arrangement that basically leads to winners and losers. And the winners are those who play their cards right, such as Germany, and have very good current account balances. And they're dependent on those who do very badly, and they have worse account balances. So Greece and the rest of the periphery have worse account balances. But, Germany has great account balances. So, the Greek problem, to put it in some kind of a comparison, it's really very little in comparison to what Germany had to spend to unify the east part of Germany.
But the German people have, at least their political authorities, have not wanted to deal honestly with them because there's a great deal of anger. And the real divide in Europe, even though Slovakia was the holdout in the last political deal that had to be done in this cumbersome mechanism that they have. The real divide is north-south, isn't it?
And
there's a kind of cultural isn't there a kind of cultural prejudice that the northerners have about the southerners?
Absolutely correct. And if you actually support that, which Chancellor Merkel has done this by going to the parliament and say that I am not really your leader, you will decide what I will agree. Whether it will be the rescue package for Greece or the expansion of the European Financial Stability Facility or even the European Financial Mechanism. So on the basis of this, you don't have anyone who actually will say, look, I have a vision, and the vision is the same as Herbert Kohl. He's basically, and François Mitterrand were actually the two heads that developed the Eurozone and urged that there should be not only a financial union, but ultimately a political union. Well, if you want to tell the German public that Greeks are profligate, they don't work, or the same thing for the Portuguese and the rest, well, of course, you don't expect any support to come from the German public. It's impossible, especially if you basically don't have a majority in parliament. You're actually a coalition, and you have to cater to the needs of those coalition members.
So, Dimitri Papadimitriou, I mean, obviously our audience is concerned that the contagion will spread, and this bank that Dexia, this French-Belgian bank that just collapsed, apparently it had substantial dealings with the J.P. Morgan Chase and
yes.
Goldman Sachs. So, and there's never any transparency in these deals, is there, really, in terms of who's really exposed? The contagion itself, though, I mean, the sickness itself started, surely, with Lehman Brothers, and that set an example where vast amounts of private debt are turned into public debt. In other words, irresponsible bankers get into trouble, and then the government bails them out. And it's happened here. We began this malignant trend, if you will. It happened in Ireland. It's happened in all the other countries as well. How do you stop this? This seems to be the new normal, isn't it?
You're absolutely on spot on this. It started here, and that had to do with the fact that there was no supervision and no regulation of financial institutions. And therefore, they expanded in areas that they actually did not know what the risk was. They could not calculate the risk. So now you see why the Federal Reserve is trying to pick up the pieces and extended all these swap agreements for dollars with the ECB because of the exposure of the United States banks to those European banks. And therefore, you know, we're trying to do whatever we can do here, but you cannot do anything unless there's strict regulation supervision, what it is that banks, our banks here in the United States, can do and cannot do. We can see, for instance, that the Dodd-Frank bill is basically dead on arrival. I'm not optimistic that anything will happen. You know, we're talking about the Volcker rules, and the Volcker rules now have been stopped. And they become more complicated, that even Volcker said, well, you banks have made it so complicated that now it's your fault, basically, that you cannot control it.
Yeah, but what's real simple is returning to Glass-Steagall, right? And nobody wants to take that seriously?
Well, a different kind of Glass-Steagall, not really Glass-Steagall. Well, Glass-Steagall was, you know, back in a long time ago.
Sure, but something...
Years. So you need to have a different kind of structure of regulation and supervision that will understand that you cannot impinge in the market because financial innovation will take place, but you should be able to have a regulatory structure that understands what the financial instruments are that are being sold and bought in the market.
Well, just in closing then, Dimitri Papadimitriou, having just returned from Europe and the meetings took place on Sunday, they were inconclusive. Now they're having another meeting on Wednesday. And as you pointed out, they know what the problems are, but they don't seem to be able to grapple with them or get their hands around them. We know that the U.S. is exposed, that the president's concerned, and so is the Secretary of Treasury. It seems to me that this is not going well, and it hasn't been going well for the last couple of years. And the longer that the political authorities dither, the worse the problem is, and they could have solved these problems years ago for pennies on the dollar. And I just have this terrible sinking feeling that we're drifting towards a deeper recession.
And I agree with you. I think that the probability of having a recession in Europe with spillover effects in the United States and the rest of the world is very, very high. I don't know what the number is. But the fact of the matter is that everyone is concerned. We know that Barack Obama and now the Chinese leader is after the European leaders to do something about it. So my suspicion is that the G20 meetings are going to be actually quite embarrassing for those for the leaders of Europe who haven't been able to solve their problem. I know that the BRICS, have been actually raising their voice, Brazil, India, and China. So my suspicion is that the more pressure that is being put on Merkel and Sarkozy and the rest might bring something about. Although I would say that I haven't always been a Cassandra, and it's very difficult to actually change since I don't see the omens out there.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Dmitry
Papadimitriou. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dmitry Papadimitriou, who is president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified on a number of occasions in hearings of the Senate and House of Representatives committees of the U.S. Congress, and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress, and was a member of the Competitive Policy Council Subcommittee on Capital Allocation. He's also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about this brand new book, Oligarchy.
If we're only mouths to feed, I know no matter what you say, there's some debts you'll never pay. Working for the church while your family dies, you take what they give you and you keep it inside.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political economy at Northwestern University. He's the author of a new book, Oligarchy, which chronicles the history of ruling structure where the few rule over the many. Winters' new book studies oligarchs and elites spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, the Philippines, and the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Winters.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's a pleasure.
And your book is could not be more timely or valuable, given that there is finally a political movement here that translates the information that you have put together in your book into at least a political frame. Wouldn't you say 99% versus 1% says a lot?
Indeed it does. I think there are two things about the Occupy movement that sort of symbolize oligarchy. The first one is that they chose to start at Wall Street, which is a symbol of the concentration of money and wealth. And the second one is the theme, as you said, 99% versus 1%, which is a very large tent. And that can only be referring to the distortions in democracy that come from concentrated power based on wealth.
And you have discovered that that according to the material power index, that measured by income, oligarchs at the very top of American society have a material power index just over 10,000, which happens to approximate the material power index of Roman senators relative to their society of slaves and farmers. Can you explain this index and this hideous comparison that indicates that we have not progressed for thousands of years?
Yes. Well, first of all, it starts from the idea that people in society can be empowered in various ways. So, for example, you can be empowered because you hold high office, like President Obama or a senator. You can be powerful because you're able to mobilize many people in society, like Gandhi or Martin Luther King. And another basis of power in any society is concentrated wealth. We all know money is power, and certainly concentrated money is concentrated power. And there's a lot of ways that money translates into power. And so one of the questions I tried to ask comparatively across different kinds of societies is how concentrated is the power of wealth in different societies? And so to get this thing I call a material power index, what I did was did a fairly simple calculation. I took what was the average income or wealth of people in the bottom 90% of society, and I compared it to the people at the very top. And what I found was, if we base it on income alone, then the United States, say roughly 500 to 1,000 people at the very top in the United States, have about 10,000 times the income of the average of the bottom 90%. So I don't mean 10,000 times the poorest. I mean 10,000 times the average American. And if we do it based on wealth, that number jumps to 20,000 times. So that happens to be twice the gap of Imperial Rome. So your point is quite correct that concentration today of wealth is as bad as, or in fact much worse than it was in Imperial Rome.
And Jeffrey, when does this? Obviously, there was a tremendous disparity of wealth in the Gilded Age, and then you had the accidental presidency of Teddy Roosevelt and the trust busting, and the playing field was level a little bit, and then it got out of control again in the 1920s with the disparity growing, and then the crash of 29 leveled it out, and then through the Depression and the war. And the New Deal leveled the playing field again, but then it got completely out of whack again, starting in the 70s, and particularly with the arrival of Ronald Reagan in the 80s, where a tiny number of powerful oligarchs succeeded in convincing legislators to shift the tax burdens to the affluent strata immediately below them. And that's the point that you were just making. It's not the comparison between the oligarchs and the poorest, but it's the people who are really shouldering the burden here, which is the endangered species known as the middle class.
That's exactly right. And there's a couple things that come out of what you've just reviewed, Ian. The first one is that wealth concentration in the United States is something which has changed considerably over time. So if we go back to the 1850s or before, the United States did have disparities in wealth, but it was a much more egalitarian society than it became by the robber baron period of the Industrial Age, or even now, which is actually much worse than it's ever been. And there's another dimension to that, which is wealth is always power, but the society or the political system can calibrate or can change how freely wealth can be used to distort the political process. So again, two things have varied considerably over the U.S. history. One is the gap in this wealth power, but also how people like the Koch brothers and Citizens United and others allow people to use their wealth for their maximal political interests. And right now, we are in a moment in the United States which is worse than any other in the following sense. First of all, wealth is more concentrated in a few hands than it's ever been in U.S. history. And second, those individuals in particular, but also corporations, are able to use their wealth more freely to shape the political process than has probably ever been the case in the U.S. history.
So, Jeffrey Winters, explain to us this kind of uneasy coexistence between oligarchy and democracy that we have here, and what will tip the balance to make it completely and absolutely a kind of oligarchical or a corporate plutonomy, 100% in charge. I don't know. Do you have a sense of the percentage of how much that they're in charge now? And if there is a history of oligarchies and democracies coexisting, what can reverse this? You call it the Great American Inversion. So mm-hmm. I'm looking for the next inversion. The malignant one has happened. How about the hopeful one happening?
Well, I think things like the Occupy movement are a promising sign, because it really has not been since the period from maybe the 1890s through to maybe the 1930s that we have really seen a populist movement that focused on this issue of concentrated wealth and oligarchy and the way that oligarchy contends with democracy. We need to understand that oligarchs have a lot of advantages in their favor. For example, if people who don't have a lot of money are going to try to shape the democracy, one of the things they have to do is they have to participate directly. Look at the Occupy people. They have to actually be there physically. They have to face inclement weather in Washington and in New York. They're going to be facing snow soon. And so power from below has always made tremendous demands on the people being political. And, you know, people need to have their family lives. They need to work. So this is not easy. Oligarchs, meanwhile, deploy their power by usually employing others to do their bidding. So, for example, oligarchs can be on the golf course, or they can be sitting at home on their sofa while their money sets hundreds or thousands of people in motion to pursue their political agendas. That includes lawyers, lobbyists, accountants, all kinds of people. So oligarchs have a lot of advantages that people down below don't have. And it's, in some ways, it's not a fair fight. But there are things we can do. For example, Citizens United must be reversed. And the only way we're going to be able to reverse that is in the legislature. And that means pressure from below on our decision makers. Also, we don't have to treat corporations as persons. That's just a decision that our political system is making. That's not something set in stone. So we're seeing signs that we may be at another inversion turning point, but it is going to be not an easy battle. And everyone in that 99% has to unite.
And you've been mentioned that some of your students don't understand. They think there are rich people in America, but they don't think there are any oligarchs. I'm just trying to get a sense from you of how the light bulbs have gone up amongst your students as they've learned more, and as your book is providing our listeners with all of this information to understand the reality of America's economic, the power of the oligarchs over our economy and the control they have over our politics. I get letters from young activists saying, you know, you give us all this terrible information, I mean, not terrible information, but there's all this information that depresses the hell out of us about how the country's being stolen out from underneath us. What do we do? And the only, you know, whenever we try to contact organizations like, you know, environmental organizations, political think tanks, or the Democratic Party, or whatever is out there, all they get in return are solicitations for money. And these kids don't have money. They've got student debt, and they've got diminishing job prospects. How do you tap into all that energy? That's what makes me nuts about how brain dead the Democrats are. You know, they're sending out solicitations for money to kids that they've got all this energy and ideas. How do you think this energy and ideas are going to be galvanized?
Well, let me take that by starting with the point you began with, which is that there is this, when I talk about oligarchy in Indonesia or ancient Rome or Athens, a lot of people nod their heads. But when you talk to Americans about oligarchy in America, they begin to have a skeptical look on their face, or a lot of them do. And they'll say, well, we have rich people in America, but we don't have oligarchs. And so one of the difficulties I've had to overcome is to point out how there are things very deeply in common between oligarchs that we have in the United States now and oligarchs that have existed in other kinds of political contexts throughout history. And the one thing, the one thread that connects all oligarchs throughout history is that concentrated wealth is not an equilibrium outcome, as we say. That is, concentrated wealth needs to be defended. And those with concentrated wealth are as focused in the United States on defending their wealth position as anyone ever has been in history. And one of the ways they do it, as you mentioned, is in the tax code. Now, when it comes to the, where you ended the question, which is what can people do? It's very interesting that those same young people were a part of society which was very invigorated by the Obama campaign. He really got a lot of people who were apolitical involved. He got them working for them, and he energized them. He gave them hope. The sad part of the story is the moment Obama became prominent, the huge money came in to back him. It overwhelmed the small money and the activism and the direct activism that was, you know, get out the vote and all those things that young people were doing to try to bring change to the United States. And as soon as Obama got into power, he turned to Wall Street. He turned to the lobbyists. He turned to the very oligarchic power centers that he had said he was going to fight against.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
The king eats another mouthful of soil. You need a full stomach to go and drill for oil. They want you lost in your own fear.
You who quit the legends, you who poisoned all of my dreams, you who pinned all of the medals on all the boys from Omaha Beach. Hope you haven't got too lazy. I know you like your apple pie, 'cause the working poor you've been pissing on are doing double shifts tonight. What could, what could.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. The Europeans failed to agree on how to stop the Eurozone crisis from deepening. They're going to meet again on Wednesday. It's pretty clear that the political abilities to deal with these problems, the politics are too slow, the markets are too fast. Europe is there, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen there with 27 members, etc. The long and the short of it is it looks as though in the real world, we're going to have a deepening economic crisis here in this country. It'll spread from Europe. And, I'm sort of running out of belief that the Europeans are going to get their act together. Greece has already gone off the cliff. Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, they're all teetering. So then you have to ask yourself, well, how is this going to impact the United States? Well, it's going to make our recession deeper and longer. And who is going to benefit from that? The very people whose economic policies got us into the disaster in the first place and whose current economic policies of austerity are going to dig the hole even deeper and make it worse. I mean, isn't this bizarre? I mean, if I'm correct, that the oligarchs and their political hirelings in the Republican Party are going to be rewarded?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this is that oligarchs are extremely good at looking at their own narrow bottom line interests. What they tend not to see is that by pursuing those interests aggressively, they can actually upset the whole cart, the whole national cart that they happen to be embedded within. So, for example, if we go back and we look at the tremendous depression of 1929 and the years that followed, all of the changes that came basically to save the system. And that included putting more burdens on the wealthy. But the welfare system and the other Glass-Steagall and other policies that were put in place, business and capital and oligarchs came kicking and screaming. And the fact is that that system that was put in place saved them. And I'm not so sure that first of all, I agree with you. We are in a very, very deep crisis, and I don't see things getting better in the short run. And I also don't see Republicans very interested in creating jobs. I mean, talk about short-sighted. Their view is all they care about is knocking Obama out of the presidency, and if that means making sure no one gets jobs between now and the 2012 election, so be it, is their view. And that's not only vicious, I think that's short-sighted, because the United States is in a very precarious situation, especially with all the things you've just described going on in Europe on the financial side. This is a fragile economy, and it's a fragile politics also, if people play it right on the edge.
So, but the point I wanted to make, and it's hardly any great revelation, Jeffrey Winters, is that, you know, I'm just harking back to James Carville's adage that it's the economy, stupid, and no president has been reelected with over 9% unemployment since FDR, and that was at the height of after the crash in the early 30s. So the prognosis is not good for Obama. And as much as you are quite accurately critical of how he in effect abandoned the base who were supporting him both financially and with their bodies on the line, if you will. That election, by the way, the last election where the candidates actually took the federal money that's in place was, I think, Carter and Reagan. They both ran on federal money. As you know, Obama made the choice not to go with the federal money. McCain tried to shame him into it, but he then went out and just got all of this huge amount of money to outspend McCain, and probably in retrospect, it probably wasn't even necessary, because what killed McCain was the financial crash of 2008.
Yes, and I must say you're pointing out something which is extremely interesting, which is that the myth of the Obama fundraising is that he had, you know, millions and millions of small donors that really funded him, as if he was a populist upsurge. We need to be clear that the data show that it was small donations which played a very important role for Obama early. But once he became a strong contender against Hillary Clinton within the Democratic Party, huge, huge money came in. And he was as bought and paid for by big money as any other candidate in the system has ever been. And it's not just that Obama abandoned his base. I think it's worse. He energized that base first and then abandoned them, which is sort of a little it's a slap on both cheeks. Whether or not he's going to prevail in 2012, I think is going to turn mostly on whether the Republicans are able to come up with a viable candidate or not. It appears that they're having a tremendously difficult time doing that, because none of the candidates is really viable other than Romney, and Romney does not excite the Republicans. So if anything saves Obama for a second term, it's not going to be that he's done such a great job. It's going to be that the Republicans run such a lukewarm candidate.
But Jeffrey Winters, my fear is that given the Carville adage that it's the economy, stupid, and the economy is going to get worse, the Republicans could run a cocker spaniel and get it elected. I mean, when you mention Romney, you're talking about a minor oligarch, I guess Bain Capital, which he headed up. I think he's worth about $250 million. If you take the example of Berlusconi in Italy, where you get an oligarch actually running a country, couldn't that happen here? I mean, with even a Romney, who's by far the most reasonable of the Republicans, you've got the Koch brothers out there that have funded the Tea Party movement that has captured the political agenda and moved the Republicans to the right. I mean, as bad as people have described Obama, I would think that the idea of being run 100% by oligarchs isn't that on the horizon?
It is a very real prospect on the horizon. I'm not downplaying the fact that that Obama is very potentially looking at a one-term presidency. You're right, it is the economy. The economy is bad, and it's not going to get better. I'm certain of that. There's not enough time, and there are, if anything, indications that it is getting worse, not better. So the conditions are favorable for a Republican takeover of the White House, and it looks like they could also dominate Congress in both houses as well. So it would be a clean sweep. And what kind of policies that portends for the United States? Well, one thing is clear: however much the Democrats are bought by oligarchs. My definition of the Republican Party is organized selfishness, and my definition of the Democratic Party is organized selfishness with guilt. So the Democratic Party is not as wholeheartedly behind the oligarchs as the Republicans are. So it's going to get tougher for the average citizen, I think.
And let's talk then about your book, Jeffrey Winters, here. Again, professor of political economy at Northwestern University, the new book, Oligarchy. The book is clearly much needed and very timely. And just explain to us how the work that you've done going back to the Greeks and the Romans and going through, and you're a specialist on the Suharto regime in Indonesia. Walk us through how these ancient and contemporary examples help us understand more about America's oligarchy, and particularly how it coexists with our democracy, which perhaps is one of the reasons why, I've been talking about this for a couple of years now, and people think I'm a broken record. And you've had some resistance from your own students trying to explain to them that this is real. Walk us through that, if you will.
Okay, well, my work on oligarchs began, of course, in the part of the world that I've studied and worked on the most, which is Southeast Asia, and especially Indonesia. And I observed the power of oligarchs in that society, especially under Suharto, and especially after Suharto fell. And as I began to think about oligarchs, I realized if I'm going to do a serious work on how the power of wealth operates in different political systems, from authoritarian to democratic, I'm really going to have to look at the whole scope and the whole picture. So this book, I didn't churn this out overnight. It took me about 7 or 8 years to do all of the research and do all of the preparation. But here's the one thing I could say that really helps put American oligarchs in perspective. I said a moment ago that the number one political thing that oligarchs throughout history have always had to contend with is their wealth attracts threats. Those threats can come from below, from people who don't have wealth, but many of the threats throughout history have come from other oligarchs. That is, they're predatory toward each other. And in some cases, threats to concentrated wealth can come from the state through redistribution and taxation and so on. So what I basically said is, if wealth defense is the number one problem that oligarchs have had to face, then how has that political task, how has that political objective changed over time? And probably the biggest transformation is this, Ian, that throughout most of history, oligarchs have themselves had to be armed figures. They have actually had to engage in violence themselves. They've had to rule directly, and they've had to be mounted on horseback with a sword, essentially, to be able to defend their own claims to wealth. So think of knights and lords and so on. They were oligarchs, but they were also military figures. And so if your wealth doubled in, say, the medieval period, you would have to build more castles, more moats. You would have to expend part of your wealth to defend your wealth. Here's what's amazing about the United States in the modern era. If I go from being Warren Buffett, who has $20 billion, to being Warren Buffett, who has $40 billion, I don't have to spend any more money to protect my wealth, even though I experience such a dramatic change. And that's because our whole system, our whole government, defends the wealth of the wealthy. And this is unique in the modern period. So that's just one comparison between the ancient period and the modern period. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of Americans think we only have rich people and we don't have oligarchs. But I can assure you that if the government, if the police forces, and if the military stopped defending wealth, you would see things like we see in Latin America, which is rich people take up arms again and defend their wealth directly.
Well, curiously enough, Warren Buffett, who you mentioned, said some time back that we're in danger of becoming a plantation economy. And do you think that when one says things like that, that we're in danger of becoming a plantation economy, when you talk about America being ruled increasingly by oligarchs and our democracy is threatened, if not facing extinction, how much is it a question of framing, which is why I think getting your book so important, is that we're going to have to start framing arguments and starting building a political movement. Now, it's happened spontaneously, and I think it's one of the best things that's ever happened is this 99% movement, but there's no guarantees that it's going to last. And as you say, they're facing a long winter, and essentially the only way to take the country back from the oligarchs is through people's bodies showing up.
Yep, that's very true, and we're seeing signs that this this movement is going to face an uphill battle in a lot of ways, and we shall see how it plays out. They've got their own internal issues of how they're going to run themselves politically, what issues they're going to focus on most. All of this is going to have to be played out. It's too early to call. One thing is for sure, these folks have struck a chord. When you talk about framing, they've struck a chord throughout the country, and in fact, it's even spread internationally. So what is it that has caused more than 1,000 occupies to arise in cities all around the United States? And I believe it is a feeling of disenfranchisement. That is, people in America's democracy today look out and they say, money and Wall Street and a very small, powerful set of interests is dominating the entire country. Our choices are extremely narrow. The policies we talk about mainly benefit the wealthy against the average or the poor citizens. And that theme has resonated very broadly and very, very quickly. Now, it is up to this movement to connect themselves, whether they do it digitally, in the blogospheres, or however they do it. The challenges are huge for them to keep the momentum going. And I think it's vital for American democracy that they do keep it going.
Well, surely at some point or other it has to translate into electoral politics, and whether that happens in 2012, next year, which is going to be a record year for billions spent, remains to be seen. But just in closing, Jeffrey Winters, there is no doubt that the U.S. government is not of the people, by the people, and for the people. That's the most scandalous thing of all, is that these incredibly powerful oligarchs like the Koch brothers are using their political muscle to destroy the Environmental Protection Agency because they find that inconvenient in terms of the profits they can make from Georgia-Pacific and from their oil company holdings. So they want to be free to pollute even more. agribusiness, the military-industrial complex, we have a unique political system in where instead of taxpayers getting social services in return for their money, what little we have in the form of social security, social services like Medicare and Social Security are now being threatened. And meanwhile, the privatization of public money is been going on inexorably since the time that you point to the rebirth of the modern oligarchy in the 1970s. That is another concurrent story, surely, how's the U.S. government itself and the Treasury is being captured by the oligarchs. Not that they, you know, that they need it, but this seems to be an example of unbridled greed.
Well, there is I've coined a new term called the income defense industry. And this industry arose in the 1960s and 70s, and it is literally armies of thousands and thousands of professionals who do nothing day and night for their day job except serve the interests of oligarchs. It is accountants, lawyers, wealth management professionals, and their job is to make sure that oligarchs not only get their tax bracket reduced, but to make sure that they never pay more than 50% of their tax bracket. And they do this through things like tax opinion letters, which most of us have never heard of. It costs between $300,000 and $3 million for a single tax opinion letter, which will help an oligarch not pay taxes. The U.S. Senate has estimated that just from the use of tax havens offshore, per year, oligarchs avoid paying $70 billion, that's with a B, dollars per year that we don't get into the Treasury. So there's a whole side to this oligarchic power and story, which is off the political radar screen. But if I could end on a positive note, Ian, it would be to say that we are an oligarchy, but we are also a democracy. It's actually a combination of both. And the hope is that people realize that they do have the power to limit. They may not be able to completely eliminate, but they certainly can diminish the distorting power of oligarchs. And it's up to Americans to do so.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jeffrey Winters.
It's been a pleasure and an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political economy at Northwestern University. He's the author of the new book, Oligarchy, which chronicles the history of a ruling structure where the few rule the many. His book studies oligarchs and elites spanning a range of historic and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, the Philippines, and the United States. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.